Let's call this meeting of the House Fisheries Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:03 p.m. Thursday. Excuse me, 5:03 p.m. Thursday, February 10th, 2011. Present are Representatives Miller, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Johnson, and myself, Chairman Representative Thompson. At today's meeting, the committee will be receiving an overview of the Alaska Board of Fish. Also on the agenda is consideration of House Joint Resolution 8 opposing genetically modified salmon. We have with us Jim Marcotte, Executive Director of the Board for the Department of Fish and Game. Mr. Marcotte, if you'd please come forward, put yourself on the record, and continue with your presentation. I'd like to remind members, you should feel free to ask questions as they arise, and please turn off your cell phone so that we don't have any problem with our sound system. Go ahead, Mr. Marcotte. Oh, about caught you there, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Jim Marcotte from the Department of Fish and Game. I serve as the Board of Fisheries Executive Director, which I've done for 5 years now. By way of background, I've worked for the Subsistence Division at Fish and Game for about 13 years in the interior, based in Galena and in Fairbanks, and then for the last 15 years with the Board Support Section, both at the regional level and the statewide level, with the Board of Game for 3 years and most recently with the Board of Fisheries. I find the board process highly engaging. It's a fascinating junction between fishery managers and the public, and it serves a key role in ensuring that Alaska's fish resources are managed on a sustained basis.
Representative Herron has joined us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The Board of Fisheries takes the politically charged issue of allocation away from the fishery managers and politicians. And separating allocation and conservation decisions is a critical element of achieving sustainable fisheries in the state. The quote above, or on this slide here, really highlights the key role that the Board of Fisheries has, and that is of allocating the fishing opportunity. I might mention that the state's authority is within the 3-mile limit. Now, there are exceptions where they manage out to 200 miles on a few species, and a few other species the federal agencies manage all the way to shoreline. But in general, the state management is within the 3-mile limit. And my focus here today is on the Board of Fisheries, but also for your information, the Board of Game has a very parallel process. The board is made up of 7 members. They serve 3-year terms. The terms are staggered. They start at the beginning of July. They're appointed by the governor and subject to legislative confirmation. All the members serve at large, and so there are no districts or stakeholder groups or ties to geography, other than historically the board has had members from a wide variety of places throughout the state and a wide variety of fishing backgrounds. I do have in the second packet there a list of the current board members, and I might point out that 3 of the seats expire at the end of June this year, so we should be expecting the appointments or reappointments for those 3 seats sometime in March. And typically the House Fisheries Committee, the House Resources Committee, and the Senate Resources Committee will hold hearings on those appointments by the governor. This major steps in the board process begins with the board issuing a call for proposals, which is done annually. Proposals are due by April 10th. This year it's actually April 8th because the 10th falls on a Sunday. We collect the proposals, type them up in the proposal books, and I've got an example for you here. These are available at fish and game offices. This one runs some 290 some odd pages of different proposals. But the good news is all that information is available in the summer, and it gives the public about a 4 to 6 month period to review the proposals and to send in their comments and inform the board. We have a distribution list of about 2,800 people. We also post the proposals on the board's website. I'll go into the meeting in a little bit more detail in a minute, but I will mention that once the board does adopt any change, the new regulations get written up, and they are reviewed by the Department of Law's regulations attorney and then sent on to the lieutenant governor, and then they become effective 30 days after signing. The Board of Game regulations are generally effective July 1st. The Board of Fishery regulations are effective at various times of the year, generally about 2 to 3 months after the meetings, because they meet any time from November through March, typically. The board follows a three-year meeting cycle. They address different fisheries in different geographic areas of the state on a three-year rotation. So this year, the board is focusing on the Cook Inlet area and the Kodiak and Chinook fisheries. Next year, the board will turn its attention to the fisheries in southeast Alaska, plus Prince William Sound and the Copper River. And then the following year, it'll go back to the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim area and western Alaska areas such as Bristol Bay and the Alaska Peninsula. And in that second packet, I have all the meeting dates listed for the rest of the cycle, and then also next year's meeting cycle that'll bring things up to March 2012. We have a proposal form that we encourage the public to use. We don't actually require the form, but just the format. We ask that the folks address the specific questions, like what is the issue that you're trying to solve? What's your recommended solution? Did you consider other solutions? We have a couple questions there about who will benefit by your action and who may be hurt by your action. And that's a recognition that most of the fisheries in the state are fully allocated fisheries. So if you're going to give more fishing opportunity to one group, almost by definition, you have to give less fishing opportunity to another group. And I will point out that just last month we added the capacity to accept proposals online, and that should streamline our the steps that our staff goes through in producing the proposal books. Proposals come in from a variety of sources. About half of them come in from individuals. Maybe another 20% come in from the local fish and game advisory committees. I'll point out that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has to follow the same procedures and meet the same deadlines to get their proposals in front of the board. They account for maybe somewhere less than 20% of the proposals, typically. And also various fishing groups and associations send in proposals, village councils, and some of the federal regional councils involved with subsistence topics will send in proposals as well. The board generally meets about five times a year. Meetings will typically last 7 to 10 days, sometimes shorter, sometimes a little bit longer. But the board is in session about 35 to 40 meeting days a year. So it's a very significant commitment that the board members make to volunteer their time. They do get a honorarium for the meeting days, but for every meeting day they spend several days doing preparation work for that. So it really is a labor of love that the board members have that they put in on this. The meetings start with department staff reports, followed by public testimony. They'll have a cutoff time for signing up for public testimony and go through the entire list for of names of folks that signed up on time. And then following public testimony, the board will break into committees where they'll take the proposals one at a time with the stakeholder groups and explore them in greater depth along with department staff. And the committees can be very productive for figuring out alternative solutions or figuring out if there's compromises that can be made or other ways of approaching some of the issues. And then at the end of the meeting, the board goes through in their deliberations proposal by proposal and takes they review them, full discussion, and then they'll take an action. All portions of the meeting are open to the public, and for the last couple of years, we've been able to offer a live audio web stream on the internet. Once in a while, we have internet connections, and that's real frustrating for folks that are expecting it, but our track record's been increasingly better on that front. Overall, about a third of the proposals that are sent in are adopted in some form or another. The boards can adopt them as written or amend them and then adopt them. And then this chart on the screen here that shows some of the proposals have no action. Those are proposals typically where maybe the board would get four or five proposals on the same issue or same topic. They'll deal with one and take care of that issue and then simply take no action on the other related proposals. The board relies very heavily on input from the public. And for example, at this upcoming meeting, we'll probably have 140 to 160 folks sign up and present oral public testimony. We've got a stack of some, I think it's about 77, 78 documents that have already been sent in for written comments on the proposals coming up at their next meeting. In addition to the general public, various fishing groups and associations send in comments, local industry or industry groups, local governments, tribal groups, and village councils, and the board also gets input from the local fish and game advisory committees. This slide shows a list of all the local fish and game advisory committees in the state. In total, there are 82. Of these 82, a little over 70 are quite active. It's a state-sponsored system. The meetings are some of the committees may only meet once or twice a year. Funding travel is a limiting factor for committees off the road system. Other committees that are on the road system can meet more often and will meet almost monthly, if not more often, before large regional meetings or before large regional board meetings. They'll have 9 to up to 15 members on them. The area management biologists typically will attend. There's great back and forth dialogue with important information going both directions. And within the board support section, we have our regional staff helping coordinate travel for the meetings, helping chairmen with agendas, getting information to them, and so forth. The advisory committees also send representatives to Board of Game and Board of Fishery meetings. That's a state-funded item. And the role of the advisory committees is exactly that. It's advisory. They have no direct authority, but the boards do rely very heavily on their input. And in total, there's over 900 members that volunteer their expertise to inform the two boards. And my plug for the advisory committees is that it's the advisory committee system is one of the best bargains in state government with that large number of volunteers and the expertise that they offer. The board also receives input from various agencies. First off would be the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Depending on the issues or topics, they would get direct recommendations from the Commercial Fisheries Division or Sport Fish Division or the Subsistence Division to inform the board on biological and management and subsistence use in background. Occasionally, Habitat Division will play a role at the board meetings also. The Department of Law has an attorney assigned to cover board and fishery items, or actually two attorneys. And the also at the table, we have a representative from enforcement concerns. And so that any of the regulations that the board might consider can be looked at from the enforceability and what this means for actual enforcement out in the field. There's seat at the table for the a representative of the federal subsistence program. The state and the federal programs endeavor to coordinate as closely as possible to minimize the impact on harvesters and to minimize adverse impacts on the resource. So we do have good working relationships between the state and the federal boards. The other key federal board on the fishery side is the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and the Board of Fisheries will hold a joint meeting with the council annually. And sometimes it's a full joint board and council meeting. Other times it's a subset of the two boards sitting together as what they call their joint protocol committee. But coordinating state and federal management is very critical. There are several legal sideboards that the board must operate within, such as obviously the state constitution, state statutes, court rulings, international treaties, and the board's own regulations and policies. So I'll mention a few of these. The primary one being the state constitution, and we are all very fortunate that the authors of the state constitution had the wisdom to include the sustained yield principle. There are no other states that have that in their constitutions, and having it anchored in the state constitution is very influential on how fisheries are managed in Alaska. This is really unique in a world where many other fisheries have been overfished. And the sustained yield principle is a principle that supersedes other interests from competing fishing groups. It has tends to have a unifying effect. It's the one thing that different groups can really agree upon. The state constitution also lays out a directive that natural resources, including fisheries, be developed for maximum benefit of its people. The board gets its direct authority from you, the legislature, specifically through Alaska statutes 1605-221 and 1605-251. The board also has statutory guidelines such as the Administrative Procedures Act, that's things like their 30-day legal notices and so forth, open public meetings, and the Executive Branch Ethics Act precludes board members from acting on proposals where they have a direct personal or financial interest. So at the beginnings of meetings, the board reviews where there may be conflicts, and the chair will make rulings, and or the board members will recuse themselves from participating where they would have a direct conflict. Another statute is the allocation criteria. It's started out as a board finding and then got brought into the state statutes. When the board is dealing with an issue that has allocative implications, it reviews the history of each fishery, the number of participants, the importance for personal and family consumption of the fish products, the availability of alternative resources, the importance that the fisheries in local, regional, and the state economy, and the importance for providing recreational opportunity. Another very important law is the state subsistence law. I understand you heard an overview of the subsistence division earlier this week from Director Jim Simon, so I won't be covering that at all, but this flowchart does show the legal steps that the board follows as it implements the state subsistence law and ensures that there's a priority for subsistence uses. And on various proposals, they may be at one or several of these different steps. So that is something that the board is very knowledgeable in and gets guidance from the department on. The board has some regulations, or the board has some policies that it established on its own. And a prominent one there is the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Policy. They also have an escapement goal policy, mixed stock salmon fisheries policy, and a policy on emerging fisheries. There are several other procedures that the board has on various items. One area is how to deal with topics that come up out of cycle, out of that three-year cycle. So they have a policy for what they call agenda change requests. These are things that people have asked the board to take up out of the regular three-year cycle. And so they've got some specific criteria for that. They require that the agenda change requests come in 45 days before their first meeting in the fall, and they review those at their work session in October. There's also a joint board petition policy, or an emergency petition policy, where if something is unforeseen or unexpected that comes up at some other time of the year, the board can address issues on a very short notice. But if they do take action through their petition process, they're limited to adopting only an emergency regulation that would be effective only for 120 days. So they can't use that fast track system to make a permanent change in the regulations. We are often promoting the board's, the public involvement in the board, and these are some of the ways that we encourage the public to get involved through getting on our mailing list, submitting proposals, reviewing proposals, attending board meetings, presenting testimony, attending local fish and game advisory committees, or working with stakeholder groups. So, in summary, the board follows a very structured process. The public credibility is a very important part of it, and there's a high level of public participation. So with that, I will thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you today, and I'll be glad to try to answer any of your questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Marcotte. Any questions from the members? Representative Herron?
A couple of questions for the speaker, but presenter. Mr. Chairman, I have four questions that I would give to you to put into the record, and then if we could ask for a written response for back to you so you can distribute it to the committee members. I won't dwell on those at the moment. Mr. Chairman, my first question is, I appreciate slide 17. That's good to have a map, a roadmap of how those subsistence decisions are made. But, Mr. Chairman, the question is, to Jim, is slide 12, North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Has there ever been a quote-unquote subsistence seat?
The Chair, Representative Herron. I don't believe there has been a subsistence seat specifically on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. That's the council structured differently, and it's part of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And some of the seats are, right, I don't have it off the top of my head for the structure, but I think there's 11 seats. Some are non-voting and so forth. But I understand you may have an opportunity to have their executive director, Chris Oliver, present information. So that would be good.
Mr. Chairman, well, if you could, Jim Koo, you could pass on to the commissioner, and then maybe she could pass on to the governor, that if you look at the state of Alaska, I don't care if you're from urban Alaska or rural Alaska, is there so many waters that our subsistence users are dependent on. And so federal seats and big factory seats, et cetera, it seems that the guys sitting around the table here who are subsistence users as well, is maybe we should have a voice at that council level as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Representative Kawasaki.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just we can follow up on the questions to the answer later, but there's a proposal in the Board of Game dealing with access to taxidermists.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there's a comparable one, because it was produced by the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. I wonder if there's one in the Board of Fish proposal.
Okay. Through the Chair, Representative Kawasaki. No, there is not a similar proposal submitted to the Board of Fisheries. And there might be in 2 years during the statewide finfish cycle. But this cycle, it would not have, that topic would not have counted as one of the topic areas the board's considering. But we have not seen that proposal on the fish side yet.
And I just have two more quick ones. This is probably a longer-term discussion that the committee ought to take up at some point in time. But of course, Chitna dip netting, one of our favorite things to do up north. We always get in the debates on personal use, and actually on the definition. And I know that where was dealing with the wildlife troopers on a specific issue up in Fairbanks was that when we're allowed to use fish, when we're allowed to give it away. When we're not allowed to give it away, and questions like that, and maybe we can have some clarification on that definition at some point in time. And maybe that's a public safety issue, too, that we need to talk about.
Right.
And then last, because we brought it up, was just on the allocation criteria. It was a couple slides back. You know, we talked about the history of the fish, the participants. Just folks up in Fairbanks are always angry about the number of fish they're not allowed to catch in Chitna. I just wanted to let you know that. And I know that the mission of the main function of the board here has been talking about the taking the allocation away from fisheries managers and politicians and putting it into a non-partisan, a board that doesn't have the conflicts that politicians do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we wouldn't have a problem, I guess, and I know there's legislation in this legislature dealing with the allocation issue in Chitna, if we felt that allocation criteria were dealt with more appropriately. So that's just my soapbox.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Common appropriateness, I guess, is relative, because I agree. You held up a book, first of all, and that is your proposals?
That is correct, Ms.
Is that available online?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And you also mentioned that you do streaming audio. Are the meetings online? Other than live?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, no, we currently don't have the audio archives posted. That is a goal of ours. A couple of years ago, we set goals to be able to just web stream live, so that's one of our breakthroughs in the online proposal submission. The department, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to take a look at it. I'll encourage you to do that. But just on Tuesday, the department rolled out its new website. It's a more user-based website than an agency structure-based website. And so the focus has been on getting that up and running. But to link the archives of the audio from our meetings is on our short list of goals to do in the next several months, if not half a year.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
So within half a year is the outside. So the Cook Inlet meeting will not be available for me to go back and listen to if I can't listen to it live.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Johnson. As far as accessing the audio file from our website, no. But a simple phone call to our office, we can supply the audio. It's the same system that I believe you use here, the FTR Gold recording system. And on a typically after a meeting, we hand out CDs to a number of people right there at that meeting site if they want to go home and listen in on different sections. So right now it's just live streaming and the audio is available on request.
And I appreciate that as a member of this committee I might get preferential treatment. In a few minutes I could get the answer. What about my constituents that want to listen in? Do they get the same kind of service?
Through the chair, absolutely, yes.
So
as far as getting an audio after the fact.
They're charged for that?
No, there is no charge.
Okay. And turnaround time?
If someone catches us at the meeting, the turnaround time is a matter of just a few minutes because that's when we're there, the files are on the computer. If it's after the meeting and we get our files back in Juneau. Usually, maybe it's a 1 or 2 day lag time. We can send people a CD. We can also post the files up on a transfer site because the files are too large to email. So both of our publication specialists are quite good at helping get those files out.
Mr. Chairman, and I've had some concerns from people who tried to get those and were not as successful as the scenario you just laid out. So I'm glad to hear that it's that easy, and maybe they're like me, not technologically savvy. So we'll work through that with them. A couple of others.
Go ahead, Vice Chair.
There's always this commercial fish, sports fish issue. When at the last board there was some testimony and you asked for advice from the department and you got a sports or commercial fish biologist, why is it not prudent at that point to ask for a sports fish biologist, or do you think you're going to get the same answer? Are they close? I mean, can you help me understand why we don't look for a variety of answers when we're looking for solutions and just depend necessarily on either a sports biologist or a commercial biologist or someone from totally different?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, at the board meetings, the department has staff from Commercial Fisheries Division, Sport Fish Division, and from Subsistence Division. Each of the managers, everyone has their areas of expertise. So just it's almost on a case-by-case basis who the most qualified person is to answer that question. If it's the manager of a particular fishery, and if it's a upriver sports fishery, that person will likely be from the sport fish division. If it's the manager of a commercial fleet, that would be from commercial fisheries division. Questions having to do with escapement goals, the basic conservation type issues on a resource, the two divisions work closely together as they develop those escapement goals. In fact, all those escapement goal memos that the Board of Fisheries receives are co-authored by Sport Fish and Comfish. So that's a little bit of a background. On any given moment of a board meeting, if one person presents an answer, you know, there have been times where a board member feels like there must be more to the story or what more. And so that's an ongoing area where the board members learn to, you know, probe a little bit deeper, and sometimes the board has to stand down and have some extra discussion if they are trying to probe some issue and feel like they're not able to get the information that they need.
Okay. One more, Mr. Chairman, if I might. I'm going to make my friends from Juneau happy. You know, I look at the list, and all the meetings except two are basically west of Yakutat. Most of the commissioners are, you know, South Central, Kodiak, and the two largest fisheries we have are Dutch Harbor, Kodiak, and then sports is a pretty toss-up. We could probably argue about that, but in terms of numbers, they're there. Why is the Board of Fish headquartered not closer to the users? The primary users.
Well, through the chair, would you say headquartered? Their support staff is basically myself and our board support section. We're headquartered here in, you know, this Fish and Game headquarters in Juneau, but in terms of our decentralized team of the Regional Advisory Committee coordinators in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Kotzebue. We have an open position that we're recruiting for now in Bethel, and we also have a position in Dillingham. So we're spread out through the state to help facilitate this public input. As far as the board meeting locations go, the two schedules, the one for this year and the one for next year, is not a complete picture. And I'd be glad to provide the retrospective look on where board meetings have been held in the past. I always think allocating fish is a hot topic. Allocating meeting locations also becomes a hot topic frequently. And you know, where to put a
meeting? I've been in some of those. Yeah.
Where to place a meeting that's accessible to the users. Well, which users? You know, a lot of, you know, Copper River, for example, or Cook Inlet, there's users from many different communities. And how to weigh that, and then also, you know, administrative convenience or where it's central for flying people in and so forth. So all of that gets factored in. I don't know if that helps answer your question, but I'd be glad to get you information.
It was a great dance.
Okay.
You know, you talk convenience of flying in. You've got three-quarters of your board have to fly in. I don't know where you, I don't know how often they have to come to Juneau, but the support staff has to fly out, and it just seems to me it'd be better serving the community if you were closer to the end users and the people that... I could probably say that about all government, and I would get in real trouble from looking around the table here. There's no one going to throw anything at me. It's just a question I have, accessibility, and it all goes back to the recordings and availability and the frustration that people have. I think Scott has expressed a little bit, or Representative Kawasaki, excuse me, has expressed a little bit about the Chittenden. I do the same thing. It's hard to get recordings. It's hard to get to meetings. It's hard to have input. And, you know, and I think what you've done with the online recommendations is solid and good, but it's not always been as easy as you've just described. And I hope it gets as easy, or is as easy as you've described, because it is something I watch, as you probably know. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to ask a final question, which probably will be unpleasant, but I look at the Board of Fisheries members, and none of them are from my district. But it's my understanding that it's a two-part question, Mr. Chairman. The first part is that some board members feel that they are treated like, insert any word you want to insert. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Herron, the service on the board is... Well, I may have used the word grueling before. There's a huge workload involved to go through things. This next meeting, it's 14 days long. They have 211 proposals. It can be a grind. That seems like a small number compared to a 90-day or 120-day session, certainly. But some board members do express frustration with the state per diem rates or having to deal with a state travel office and things like that. So, you know, I can't say that they just call me up and say, hey, thanks, everything's running smoothly on a regular basis. They really don't. So there are, you know, there are some challenges. I think that's maybe what you're referring to, or?
Well, again, it's not anybody I know, but from what I'm hearing, they're treated like crap, and maybe it's the professionals that, you know, that work for the department may have some biases against certain members. I'll move on. Is another complaint that you get from board members is, of course, the public is not allowed to approach them when they're at the table, right, at breaks. I mean, if they want to approach a board member, they have to, you know, they'll talk to them in the hallways or, you know, on the way to the restroom, which is fine, but the complaints that I hear from board members is when it's an extremely contentious situation, they'll choose not to go to the restroom. They'll stay at their table so that they are not hammered. Is there ever been consideration for, you know, I guess protecting is the wrong word, but, you know, sort of allowing for some civility, I guess. Is that true, or am I speaking out of school here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Herron, I would say the overall characterization of the board process, and this would apply to Board of Game and Board of Fisheries, is one of openness and accessibility. Our current chair, Vince Webster from King Salmon, had been an advisory committee chair representative for some 12, 15 years. He's very sensitive to that. During the public testimony, he explains, hey, I used to be on the other side of the table. I know how it feels. You know, just relax. We're regular folks. He explains that, yeah, if you want to get a hold of us, you know, we do take breaks. Talk to us. We need this information. So I'd say overall the atmosphere is one of access. Board members regularly will be available for breakfast meetings, lunch meetings, after work meetings. They chat with folks in the hall. Through the committee process, there's lots of dialogue. Certainly there would be, there are times where people feel like they didn't get enough access or were more hesitant, or I guess my observation is that I hear more complaints after someone comes out on the losing end of a tough issue than when they go, oh, yeah, we got our proposal passed, but we weren't comfortable with it. That rarely comes up. So I would say really on the whole, the board members really do make a point to be accessible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have one question, and it's just a procedural on your slide 9, it talks about the actions by the Board of Fisheries on their proposals.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 354 considerations, but that's 5 years old. Is that kind of an average that's still continuing, or has it really increased over the years?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that's pretty consistent. I prepared this PowerPoint originally several years ago, and a few of these slides I haven't updated, but the overall pattern for the percentage of the proposals that come in the door, where those come from, that's pretty standard, and also the board actions. I've looked at that a few times, but I just haven't updated the slides.
All right, do members have any other questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Marcotte. We look forward to working with you this year. And we'll take a brief at ease while we get ready for our next order of business. At 5:47, we're back on record. Our next order of business is to hear Joint Resolution 8. Committee members, Representative Kawasaki, the sponsor of HJR 8, is... you want to take the head table on this?
Not
or
actually,
from where
please.
You are? You're accompanied by your staff, Mr. Joss Villars. Also, Ms. J.D. Hansen with the Center for Food Safety is online in support of the resolution and available to answer questions. Representative Kawasaki?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to have my staff person who wore a salmon-colored shirt, he said. It's actually pink. Today, just for this resolution and just to introduce the resolution, I'll be answering questions afterwards. Thank you.
Great. If you'd place yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Josh Gobars, staff for Representative Kawasaki. Mr. Chairman, House Joint Resolution 8 is introduced to urge the United States Food and Drug Administration to deny application to sell genetically engineered salmon in the United States. HR 8 also calls on Congress to enact product labeling requirements that include the words genetically modified, which are prominently displayed on the package if it is approved for sale by the FDA. Recently, the FDA held hearings to approve a hybrid Atlantic salmon, the first genetically engineered animal for human consumption. The FDA's consideration for approval of this frankenfish is a risky precedent and a threat to Alaska's wild salmon. This hybrid Atlantic salmon has been engineered by crossing Chinook salmon growth genes, an antifreeze gene from an eel called the ocean pout, and the Atlantic salmon. The new creation, dubbed the Aqua Advantage salmon, will grow twice as fast as its natural cousin. Salmon farms in Canada, Europe, and South America have been criticized for crowded conditions, fecal contamination, use of chemicals, proliferation of disease, and escapees. Atlantic salmon have been caught in Alaskan waters, escaping from neighboring fish farms in British Columbia, many infested with sea lice. They are considered an invasive species in Alaska. HJR 8 will send a clear message to the federal government, Alaska's congressional delegation, the Food and Drug Administration, and President Obama that Alaska's state legislature does not condone the growth, sale, or release of genetically engineered salmon in the United States. Please join with Representative Kawasaki in supporting House Joint Resolution 8. to make Alaska salmon safe.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the sponsors? Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kawasaki, I was looking over the resolution, and there is a whereas, that's line 11 on the second page, that there is someone out there that proposes to do this. Could there be a whereas in it that that there are frankenfish being produced or in production somewhere? Is there somewhere where there is a frankenfish?
Through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Herron, to my knowledge, in the United States, there aren't any fish that have been approved or genetically modified organisms to be approved as food within the United States. That's the Food and Drug Administration. This is the first time it's come before when it comes to GMO fish. And I think my staff might also have some references to that as well.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, there are genetically modified fish. These frankenfish are being grown. What they're doing is they're breeding them in Canada and shipping them to Panama, and they are producing them there.
So Mr. Chairman, is I think in, I would suggest, it's up to the chairman, but I would suggest that there should be a whereas where indeed they're out there. As a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, question?
Representative
Kawasaki, or to staff, what is the likelihood at this time that frankenfish would be approved for consumption?
Representative Kawasaki.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I think, I mean, that's the likelihood that it is. There's a lot of money that's being invested and spent to lobby the Food and Drug Administration right now. But what I think we need to think about here is that we as a legislature and as a governing body of the state want to send that clear message that we don't want them anywhere in Alaska. Our congressional delegation, Congressman Young, Senator Murkowski, and Senator Begich have federal legislation to ban it U.S.-wide. This is just another a little bit of ammunition for them. As the Food and Drug Administration considers the Aqua Bounty docket. And I also wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, that there's urgency on this, that we do something quickly because the Food and Drug Administration is going to be closing the public comment period here very shortly at the end of the month, and this legislature really ought to be on record opposing genetically modified salmon that could devastate our own wild stocks. We just don't have enough study on it. At the very least, labeling was entered into this resolution so that we can say if they do intend to do it, we want to know as consumers that these are genetically modified salmon and not natural wild Alaskan salmon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron, you have any?
No, I'm good. Thank you, sir.
Other members have questions? Representative Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may be nitpicking a little bit, but in the first line, deny an application, I mean, does that mean they deny the first one and the rest of them are okay? Or should that be any application? I mean, I just wonder, if we're going to send this, let's say we don't deny the first one and the second one's okay. Let's be real clear that if we do it, it's any application. And it may say that, but why leave it vague if we don't have to? So just to, and we deal with resolutions like no one else in the world, by the way.
You can add a Y.
Add a Y, yeah. And that, it just, if you know, I just think it'd be appropriate to send a clear message that not just the first one, the second one, but any application. If with the, when it comes time, I'll offer that as an amendment with the sponsors. And we can leave it if you don't think it's a problem.
Good. Okay. Representative Pruitt has joined us, by the way, about 5 minutes ago.
On that note, it is, again, kind of nitpicking, but I would hate to insult the new Speaker of the House. Probably wouldn't want to call him the Minority Leader of the U.S. House of Representatives. So on line 3, or line 10 of page 3, we'll probably want to make sure that we
can. Yeah, good idea.
Yes. Oh, good catch. Thank you. Further questions from members? Representative Miller.
Since we were trying to tidy up some of the language.
Hi, Josh.
Still on page 3, line 4, if the application should probably be changed to if applications are approved.
Yeah, we're going to make it
likewise, on page 1, line 11, again, we should change that from and to any.
What was that again on 11?
Line 11, it yeah. says, whereas an application, any. Change that to any application.
Well,
no, I don't think that's not appropriate.
Leave it as an.
Yeah, the grammatic one.
Okay. Further questions from members? Mr. Gulvars, thank you very much for that presentation. We're going to open it up now for public testimony. And we do have some people online, but we will catch the people here in the room first. Jerry McCune, United Fishermen of Alaska. If you'd please come forward and state your name for the record.
I thought for sure he was here for the Board of Fish meeting.
I want to raise him though. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska, the largest statewide commercial fishing organization in the state. We appreciate the sponsor putting this forward. The time right now is very important. They're debating this issue right now. A lot of people feel the FDA is going to approve this and not require any labeling. We've spent millions of dollars, the state legislature and seafood industry, marketing our salmon. And this could cause a lot of confusion in the marketplace if they're not labeled. Somebody eats a salmon and particularly doesn't like it, they might not eat salmon again. And it doesn't sound good anywhere, Atlantic and eel and a lot of genes and different things. But so we support the resolution 100%, timing right now is right on. We don't want California to cork us with their labeling bill first. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions from members? Thank you very much. All right, we have one person online, Mike Smith from Fairbanks. He's with the Tanana Chiefs Association. Mike, are you there? Hello, Mike. Apparently we've lost him. All right. Is that you, Mr. Smith? Nope. Okay. Is there any other public testimony? Okay, we're going to take a brief at ease. And public testimony is closed. The chair will now entertain a motion to conceptually.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would like to propose an amendment if I could at this point. A simple amendment. Line 1, page 1, at the end of deny an, add a Y to deny any application so that we clarify that, and for the intent that we do clarify that any application that might be coming forth would be opposed.
All right, is there any objection to that? Seeing none, it's so changed.
Mr. Chairman, while we're on the record, I would like to put on the record that another whereas, as Representative Herron, will be addressed in a future committee that the representative, the sponsor, sets on, so that on the record it would be clear that this committee had addressed it and will look for it to be taken care of in the next committee, which is resources and an appropriate body to handle such a change.
Very good. Okay, I entertain the motion. Representative Pruitt.
Amend page 3, line 10, to say the speaker, instead of minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Yeah. Yes.
Good catch.
Yeah. Any objections to that? Hearing none, we'll have that
change. Mr. Chairman, alleged legal can take care of any of those others. It's related to line one, adding a Y in Annie, in Ann, and then they can go through and clear up all the others for your CS, sir.
Okay. Vice Chair, I'm looking for a
motion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would move that the House House Joint Resolution Number 8, as amended, with individual recommendation and no physical note.
Zero
physical note. Is attached zero physical note.
Any objections? Hearing none, we also move this out of committee. And that does conclude our business for the evening. Our next Fisheries Committee meeting will be at 5 p.m. on Tuesday, February 15, 2011. At that meeting, we will begin our industry overviews with a presentation on the sport fish section by the Kenai River Sports Fishing Association, and then hear House Bill 60 related to gooey duck farming. The time is now 6:02 p.m.